Many will come to order. We have a quorum, and do we have any minutes to approve? Where are they? Representative Rosenthal. There's a long list of things on the minutes, but. Is that the same as Friday, March 15th?
I hope so.
Okay. Are there any questions or additions? All in favor of approving the minutes, please signify by saying yes.
Yes.
Opposed,
yes.
Same sign. Minutes are adopted. The first bill up is House File. We want to go in this order. House File 1223 J. Ward. J.O. Ward. J.A. Well,
that's right.
says jail. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the tape and begin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Representative Joanne Ward, and I thank you for and the committee for hearing this bill. I'm representing, I represent portions of Ramsey and Washington counties, and I'm here to introduce a bill supporting the Washington County Regional Railroad Authority's continued efforts to advance the development of regional transitways in Washington County. These trailways, transitways, include the Gateway, Rush Line, Red Rock, and Highway 36 corridors. Investments in our transportation system will improve mobility to the east metros, and as they grow and increase, it will increase access to jobs, strengthening the business community, allowing them to better connect to their employees, their goods and services, and ultimately to their customers. Current Minnesota statute, Section 398A, allows for regional railroad authorities to expand funds to plan, develop, design, and possibly construct and operate transit improvements as long as there is a rail component being considered for the project. However, regional railroad authority statutory rights do not include bus rapid transit projects. As the Washington County Regional Railroad Authority continues to analyze its transitway corridors, bus rapid transit, BRT, is becoming a viable and cost-effective solution for implementing higher-level transit improvements. This request is to simply grant the Washington County Regional Railroad Authority the same statutory rights as BRT that are permitted for light rail transit, or LRT, allowing the authority to continue to expend funds to advance the development of its regional transitways. An identical request was granted for the Dakota County Regional Railroad Authority in 2005 to allow for the development of the Cedar Avenue BRT corridor. Here today is Washington County Commissioner Autumn Lurkey, who will provide more information about this needed legislative change.
Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Ward. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Autumn Lurkey. I'm the Vice Chair of the Washington County Board and Chair of the Washington County Regional Rail Authority. As Representative Ward noted, the bill is needed to continue to advance the development of transitway corridors in Washington County. In the Twin Cities metropolitan region, the county regional rail authorities are the primary entities that lead and fund the initial planning and development phases for regional transitways. Once transitway projects have entered into the engineering and construction phase, the Met Council becomes a lead agency, and the primary role of the Regional Railroad Authority becomes a funding partner responsible for a 10% match. We're not proposing a change to that to the current effective governance or funding formula. We simply would like to continue to advance the development of transitway corridors and consider BRT as a viable option. Although regional railroad authorities are allowed to look at BRT as an option in the initial planning and feasibility stages, if a locally preferred alternative is selected that does not include a rail component, funds can no longer be expended. This legislative change will allow Washington County Regional Railroad Authority to move beyond the feasibility stages and to help the region build out its transitway system. Mr. Chair, that concludes my testimony. Please be advised that we also have our senior transportation planner, Andy Gitzloff, in the audience, and we'd be happy to stand for any questions.
Is he going to testify or no?
No, just okay. Here for support, Mr. Chair.
Oh, that's good. Are there any questions or comments for Representative Ward or Ms. Autumn? Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Ward or testifier, can you give me a figure of how many of the total population of Ramsey County, how many people are currently using the transit system out there?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Ward.
Thank you. I just want to clarify, do you mean Ramsey County or Washington County or both?
Just the Ramsey, I'm sorry, Washington County, thank you.
Mr. Chair, members, I can tell you,
Commissioner?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I represent the southern part of the county, which the Red Rock Corridor is in, and I can tell you the ridership levels along that corridor has a daily weekday ridership of 950 people, but I can't tell you for the whole county how much of the population rides public transportation. Another thing, it's not just about moving people, it's also about the economic development piece also that wasn't really mentioned in the testimony today. But
Moore? Representative Anderson, Moore? Okay.
I'm through. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Anybody else? Anybody in the audience to testify for or against? If not, I forgot to move just beyond the table. I don't think we had that done. But now that it's getting ready to get off the table, I'll renew my motion that House File 1223 be recommended pass and sent to Transportation Finance. Any questions? Everybody in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Same sign. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Committee.
We're going to do right now. Representative Dorholt, House File 1204. You got an amendment?
It's a documentary about it.
Representative Doro, would you like to put your bill on the table here? And
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'd like to move 1204 along with the delete all amendment, which I don't know if that was passed.
Be recommended to pass and sent to Transportation Finance.
Correct.
Go ahead.
Did you get the delete all amendment?
Yep.
Okay.
And okay.
You remember the tree. You can move that, Representative Doral, as a member of the committee. That's House H.I. 204-DE1.
You got it. So that's the one we'll be working off of here. But I guess with me I have Doug Weishauer from the Central Minnesota Transportation Alliance, who's here to speak on behalf of the bill. So he can give us some background and hand it over to him.
Thank you, Representative Dorholt, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee.
Well, wait a minute. Moved the amendment, or I did, one of us.
Great.
I think you started to move it, and I finished it. So
okay.
Yes, and the motion was to amend the House File 1204 with the delete all. Does anybody have any objections or corrections to the to that motion? Seeing none, hearing none, we will vote to put that 1204 amendment on the 1204 bill. All in favor of that?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign? Okay, now we got your bill in. Sorry about that.
Thank you.
We're all set.
All right.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you, members of the committee. I am Doug Weishauer. I am a vice president with WSB and Associates, a Minnesota engineering firm, and also a chair of the board of directors of the Central Minnesota Transportation Alliance. We are based in St. Cloud. However, we have interests throughout Central Minnesota, and especially the I-94 corridor as it connects St. Cloud area and the Twin Cities. We have seen over the course of the last couple decades a great deal of growth within this corridor, especially I-94, and we have not seen corresponding improvements in infrastructure to allow for that extra traffic. So this particular bill would give us an opportunity to have another tool to find financing available to try and expand the capacity of I-94, especially in this corridor. We also know that you can't just improve 94 without also improving the 494-94 split, commonly called Fish Lake Interchange, as well as 494 as it goes down to Highway 55. So really that whole corridor is an area of interest for our group up in St. Cloud. House File 1204 would again provide a toolbox finance opportunity. We have worked with MnDOT. District 3 up in the central Minnesota area has, in fact, looked at ways to put I-94 on their transportation improvement plan, the STIP. However, we know that because of current fiscal restraints, there is no opportunity, even within the next 20 years, to see I-94 expanded given the current funding scenarios. So working with that, we would like to see you pass 1204 and move this bill forward so that we could, in fact, see these funding opportunities. What we have seen are increases in freight in this corridor, a great amount of freight increase. In fact, just recently, Lexanne Reichel of the Golden Plump Company indicated that her company produces and ships 1 million pounds of chickens every day. Think about that for a second. That's just a whole lot of chicken going up and down these corridors, primarily, they indicated, up and down I-94. They feel about half of their trucks daily sit in traffic, which costs their company $250,000 a year in lost productivity by having their products sitting instead of making it to their consumers. So those are the types of issues that we see that we feel need to be improved over the or with the use of financing opportunities. According to MnDOT studies, central Minnesota accounts for 75% of the congestion on the freeway system, and 40% of that is on I-94. So if you think about that for a second, 40% of our congested freeways within the state of Minnesota are this section of I-94 that we feel need to be improved. And again, I repeat, there is nothing within the 20-year program for MnDOT saying they can improve or expand this corridor at all. I know that there are critics in our state against the use of PPPs, and that's primarily because they say tolls will be used to finance this sort of a situation. I know that this bill calls for other opportunities besides tolls to be used as a debt service process with the public or private sector. I think you need to focus on the idea that there will be other opportunities besides just tolls to be used within this process. So again, we support the idea that we use this. We recognize that tolls are one of the funding mechanisms that could be used. We recognize also what our state citizens feel about paying tolls on roadways. We've had tolling bills passed and enacted in the past. I think they're currently off the books again. So that does not say that if there's an added lane, it may not be a min-pass lane, similar to what we currently have in our min-pass system. There are other ways to, again, handle this. But at any rate, we do, as an organization, encourage your support of this bill and ask for its enactment. With that, Mr. Chair, thank you for this opportunity.
Shut off your cell phones, please, those that have them on. Can you give me a little orientation here? I think of Highway 94 in a different spot than the St. Croix River crossing somehow. And that's mentioned in E. Can you tell me how that gets connected together?
I-94 is definitely not the St. Croix River crossing. I think that there are many opportunities where P3s could be used within the state. I-94 is one of them. I testified on I-94 because that's important to St. Cloud.
Okay.
There are other opportunities. For instance, a Mississippi River crossing between I-94 and Highway 10 would be another opportunity there that could be used for a project like this. That particular project has, in fact, had an EIS adopted. A record of decision has been issued by the Federal Highway. But there is no money to build this, and so it languishes because of lack of funds. Maybe the St. Croix River crossing could be another opportunity, although I believe that has a funding package established, and you know, I would certainly not want to see anything get in the way of that project 30 years in the making coming to fruition as well. Some of the transit corridors within the metro area, whether it be Southwest or Botno, are other potential opportunities that could be utilized for a P3 type project. You know, those are just a few off the top of my head. Somebody mentioned to me the other day, maybe, I know that the Rochester area has talked about a high-speed rail connection. Potentially, P3s could be an opportunity for a high-speed rail between the Twin Cities and Rochester. Those are just some of the thoughts that come off the top of my head, Mr. Chair.
Oh, thank you. Rochester, that's only the first billion in their hierarchy, that yeah. High-speed railroad.
Something to that effect, yes.
Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm looking at this interesting handout from the Minnesota Trucking Association that talks about a toll road in Texas, 85-mile-an-hour speed limit. Obviously, that was apparently done with the permission of the Texas DOT, but speed limits will continue to be regulated by the state, and there's no plans for any, I'm concerned about this because obviously speed is the number one cause of traffic deaths, and you don't envision doing anything like that here.
No, Chair Representative Hornstein, this should be covered in. All of these would have to meet the state guidelines for rules and regulations. They'd be subject to policing and highway patrol as any other roads are today. So it doesn't change. It wouldn't change anything like that. We wouldn't be building a super freeway like they did in Texas. So
that's reassuring. Thank you.
Representative Rosenthal.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Dorholt, or the testifier, can you just walk us through one of these private-public works and financing, how it's put together? Is it leased, and who's in charge of what, and basically how the money flows?
Mr. Chair, Representative, we don't have experience in this state with actually having done one of these, so I'm not able to, and I'm not a finance expert, but I can share with you at least what I know of how these may work. There are different ways to structure them, but one of the ways would be to lease the facility that's to be constructed to the private company for a given period of time. That given company then would assume temporary ownership, if you will, but could and probably would contract with MnDOT to continue to maintain it over that same period of time. The state then in its contract would work out a way to finance debt service that company. Some of the finance companies that I have visited with in the past have indicated that they feel they can issue lower cost loans through this process because of that process of their temporary ownership in which they can write off that facility through depreciation over the term of their lease with the state. At the end of that lease, the facility then reverts to the ownership of the governmental unit, whether it be the state or whether it be Met Council, or whether it be, you know, a county, for instance, depending on what local government or what unit of government is contracting for the facility to be built. That's a very uneducated answer, the best I can do to the question.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Rosenthal.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. These have been done throughout the country, so is there a model that you're working off of for the Minnesota model? Is it copying something that's already being done, or is it a new model?
Mr. Chair, Representative, we don't have a model totally developed at this time. I think this would be worked out with Met Council and MnDOT and the commission that would be established to oversee the development of this process. Yes, you're right. Those other states that have done these would be used as examples to build our Minnesota model. This is not dissimilar to the process that was used to start design build 12, 15 years ago, whenever that process was started. Back then, MnDOT visited other states, took in the things that they thought worked best for us here in Minnesota, and developed a Minnesota model of design-build. I would assume that very same model would be used for development of a P3 model for Minnesota.
I think there have been projects already undertaken and completed, not necessarily ongoing, but I think of one, United Health and the state on Highway 169 on an interchange, where they supplied part of the money to do that because it was in their very strong best interest. So,
Mr. Chair, you're absolutely right. That would be Bren Road in 169. Right. And my company was fortunate to be involved in that process. So that is a model of how it could be done in this state. It's not the finance model that this particular bill would allow. But that's not the only example that that's happened on. There have been other interchanges, one in Monticello at County State Aid Highway 18. Had a private developer throw $7 million in. Penn Avenue interchange on 494 had Best Buy contribute several million dollars to it. Yeah. So there have been other examples in this state of public and private partnerships.
Representative Runbeck, question?
I'll pass.
Representative Neuberger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just wanted to do a little clarification here. Maybe you can tell me if something has changed or bring me up to speed on this. Page 3, we got line 3.6 going into 3.7. Says among the projects, I'll start on 3.5. Among the projects the commission and the council or council may consider are the construction of a marked, that's a typo, it should be A, not AN, a marked Interstate Highway 94, Mark U.S. Highway 10 River Crossing near Mark Trunk Highway 24. With that targeted area, that's my district?
Yep.
Okay. I've been in communication with MnDOT, and there is a project that is slated, ready to go, I've been dealing with for some time, and it's on the books for the future. So I'm wondering if this isn't being duplicated, or if this was overlooked, or maybe there's something, I don't know. But right now there is a project set. It's ready to go. I have a stack on my desk of petition signatures. People in my district who have been fighting this for about a decade don't want it. I addressed that concern, and basically it's a done deal. That's what I've been told. It's set. It's ready to go. It's in the hopper, so to speak. So there's going to be a high-speed connection between 94 and Highway 10 that goes across the Mississippi River. They're going to be building a bridge to accommodate this. This is not to be confused with the bridge project that they're going to start in 15. They're tearing down the old bridge that connects the two in that goes from Clear Lake to Clearwater. They're tearing that down. That starts in 15. That's already funded, paid for, done deal. This is another bridge that they're going to build downriver a short way is to make this high-speed interchange connection. So I'm just curious if something has changed here, or maybe you just need to pull this off as an option, or why this. I just some clarification on this. Thank you.
Representative Darold?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Neuberger. The problem is it's on their plan for the future, right? Where's the money coming from? That is what part of this is going to address, so we can have that conversation about other options, alternative options of possibly funding that. They got a lot of stuff that's been on their future for decades. No, this doesn't mean that this is going to happen. This would mean that it would be considered one of the three specific projects be considered. So that would be one example of where they would, say, take bids where MnDOT could work. I don't know if there's anybody from MnDOT who wants to speak on that. I'm not sure how far out that's slated, but my guess is next year it would be slated out even further because of the lack of funding. Yeah,
go ahead and see that. Mr. Chair, Representative Neuberger, you're absolutely right, and it's the project I mentioned earlier that there is, in fact, a record of decision authorized by the Federal Highway as to where that will go. You're right. But it is not currently in the 20-year plan because there is no money. And so even though it is approved and it's waiting, it is not financed. So,
any other questions? Okay. I was going to ask MnDOT if they have any. You looked ready to leap up there, so I thought I'd see if you had something you wanted to say. Mr. Peterson.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Scott Peterson from MnDOT. To clarify, Mr. Wizar is correct. We do have a completed EIS, a record of decision, but no money to fund this high-speed river crossing. And, you know, given our current situation, it's unlikely that it would make its way into our construction plans in the next 20 years or so.
I suppose you'd suggest that that'd be a good reason to vote for some gas tax increase. But you don't have to.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Beard.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Peterson, it seems to me we did a one-off pilot, public partner private public-private partnership pilot program, five P's in that alliterative title there. Didn't we do that last year and give the commissioner authority to try one, then come back and report to the legislature and make sure that the wings didn't fall off? Is that in statute now, I think?
Mr. Peterson?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Beard, yes, the legislature did give the commissioner the authority to enter into a private financing arrangement.
Okay.
Finance one project as a pilot program to try and see and explore the potential of private financing for transportation improvements. The bill that's before you now goes quite a bit farther and really trying to spell out the terms of an agreement that the state could reach with a private proposer for a project that kind of expands upon that idea.
Mr. Chairman, to this point, has MnDOT, Mr. Peterson, identified one, a suspect for that one, or are we just moving ahead with expanding the concept to three before we actually put the one into play?
Mr. Peterson.
Any idea?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Beard, we haven't picked a project yet. We continue to explore the possibilities out there, but we haven't actually found a good prospect at this point.
And you haven't found any money yet either.
And Mr. Chairman, my last related question. Is this a department initiative? Remind me, I wasn't listening with both ears here just a moment ago. A department initiative, or is this the Central Minnesota initiative?
Mr. Chairman, Beard. Representative Beard, this is not a department initiative,
okay.
But this is something that is consistent with a task force that looked at P3s in Minnesota. I think it was about a year ago or so, and they made some recommendations. So a lot of the recommendations from that task force, which was a MnDOT task force, are captured in this legislation. And if I could just follow up briefly on, again, how this might open up opportunities. One of the obstacles that we've run into in trying to pursue projects for the legislation that you mentioned is they really need a revenue stream that adds more revenue to the pie, so to speak, so that we don't displace other projects in the program.
Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Chairman. Some of these amendments and bills and stuff are giving me a little bit more hope. Last week we heard about first of all, let me start out by saying I've heard for a long time that here at the legislature we don't try to earmark any projects, and that we have given great authority to the Department of Transportation to deciding which is best. And last week we heard that there now is a kind of a reverse earmark in regards to a light rail system that we can't talk about. And now here we have a situation where three particular proposals are said in the words of may be looked at for P3. So that gives me a lot more hope for Highway 14 than being in the may category as well. So I thank you for that latitude.
Is there anyone in the audience who would like to testify for or against this? Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Margaret Donahoe. I'm the director of the Minnesota Transportation Alliance. I believe that you have a couple of handouts, and if not, I can have them passed out. But I wanted to just kind of briefly talk about why the Transportation Alliance is very supportive of this legislation, and we hope that you will pass this. Public-private partnerships can be very broadly defined, anything from design-build to design-build, operate, and own, and anything in between. So we do have some experience in Minnesota with public-private partnerships, as has been described a little bit here. Some of the bigger projects like Rock 52 in Rochester was a design-build project that allowed a project that would have taken 12 years to be done more like in 4 years. So there are a lot of benefits to public-private partnerships, and they can apply to any mode of transportation. So around the country, there have been transit ways that have been financed through public-private partnerships, as well as highways and toll road or bridges. And some of the advantages are that there can be a savings of public dollars by investing private dollars in some of these projects. One of the biggest advantages is saving time by expediting project delivery, so projects are done much more quickly. Taking advantage of some of the expertise and creativity of the private sector, who have some new ideas at times about how to design and construct projects in different ways. And also transferring some of the risk from the public sector to the private sector. So those are a lot of the reasons why states around the country and local governments have looked at public-private partnerships. In addition to the fact that while we are very supportive of increasing our dedicated revenue sources for transportation, the motor fuel tax, the license tab fees, the motor vehicle sales tax, we understand that there are some larger ticket projects that are a challenge to finance, and that having access to private capital up front can be a way to get some of these larger projects built that would not otherwise be built. So we also want to call your attention to the fact that at the federal level, there's been a lot of encouragement for states to try public-private partnerships. As you'll see on this handout, over the past 22 years, Congress and the federal government have really encouraged states to try public-private partnerships through pilot programs under both T21 and SAFETEA-LU, encouraging state infrastructure banks, creating the Transportation Infrastructure Finance and Innovation Act, also known as TIFIA, which provides loans for these kinds of public-private partnerships. And just the last federal authorization bill, MAP 21, provided some language to encourage public-private partnerships by requiring the U.S. Department of Transportation to assist states with technical assistance, with model contracts for them to use with private companies. And so we can see all around the country that this is being seen as a way to get some projects built that won't otherwise probably be built with the amount of public financing that's available. I also just want to reiterate that, again, this is very permissive language. It allows three projects to be done. As you heard from Mr. Peterson, we probably won't see a huge rush of private investment in our state, of private companies that want to build a lot of highways. But we're hoping that with the creation of an office that would involve different state agencies as well as some stakeholders, that the state could be a little more proactive in finding some good candidates. Just like the state tries to be proactive in attracting businesses to invest in our state, we think that getting private capital to invest in our transportation system will also help our state to improve our infrastructure and, again, allow for some of the projects that you heard about, although there could be others, that might get done that won't otherwise get done. So. And again, I also wanted to just reiterate that in the language before you, tolling would only be authorized for new capacity, so it would not be allowed for existing general purpose lanes, and that's very similar to the policy that we have in place now with MinPass lanes, where people have a choice. They can choose to pay and drive in the lane that gets them where they want to go faster, or they have other options that don't require a payment. And that's the kind of facility that's envisioned in this legislation. Thank you.
Representative.
Thank you, Madam, Mr. Chair. Just a question as to whether there are any projects that would be prohibited. I mean, are there experimental kinds of futuristic transportation pilots that if there's money for it and people who want to do them, there'd be a willingness to give those a go? Or, you know, where do we draw the line? Does this say anything about that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Runbeck, it is pretty open. I mean, the one restriction that would be, you know, that has to be subject to state laws that exist, such as speed limits and police and highway patrol being able to access it as any other road, as well as the adherence to any new, only tolls can only be used for new and expanded capacity. So it is pretty wide open. It is meant to open the door to maybe, you know, Jetsons type traveling around magnetic roads and no engines and cars. Who knows?
Well, thank you, Representative Dorholtz. And Mr. Chairman, I'm certain this will make Mark Olson happy.
Yeah, I was just thinking.
Pods. Anyway, a second question, though, Mr. Chairman. So why then on page 3, 3.9 and 3.10, why do we mention the St. Croix River crossing? It just seems, I mean,
sure.
Is that not already done business?
Mr. Chair, Representative Runbeck, it had to make it through the Senate, so which is where it got here. That was what was added in the Senate side in order to get through. It's a project that near Oak Park Heights there that they wanted to explore the possibility of that. So that was a large topic of discussion. So I think I'm not supposed to mention that other body. That's how it ended up there.
Thanks.
Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Chairman. I just wanted a quick clarification on this new office that's being created. Whenever we expand government, I think we need to be real effective in making sure that it's worth the position and worth doing, because it's going to be a cost to it. What do you envision that office actually entailing, and how much work and how much time that's going to take in order to manage that office? Because I believe it's going to have to be a lot of promotion as well.
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative, you may recall that Representative Mason had another bill that also was a department initiative that creates an office with a number of people from different agencies. This calls for a little different mix of additional people, but their goal with that was to use existing personnel who would basically meet and work on trying to do a better job of coordinating because public-private partnerships can be related to transportation, but they can also be related to other areas of infrastructure. And to build that kind of expertise in negotiating these kinds of contracts, it can take people from multiple agencies. And so to have an office that's kind of ongoing would facilitate that without necessarily adding additional people or additional space, or it would be more of a coordination function.
Representative Peter.
Just as a follow-up, so, and I know this is a policy committee, not necessarily a finance committee, but where would you see the funding come from? That would it be coming out of the private partnership arrangement, or would it be coming out of the general Department of Transportation funding, and how would we justify by that?
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative, right now the work that people at MnDOT do related to getting projects ready for letting or managing, overseeing those projects is considered part of the project cost. So it could very well be that some of the expenses of this office could be included in the cost of a particular project.
Representative Petersburg.
Thank you. Yes, but and I think you're absolutely right. It is included part of the cost, but all the things that they would do for other projects would be in addition to this particular office. So this would be an actual addition to that cost and not a supplementation. So that's curious. That's all.
Okay. Anybody else that wants to testify for or against?
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Amber Backus from the firm of Leonard Street & Dinard here on behalf of the Minnesota Trucking Association, and we are here today to express some of our concerns about House File 1204. We have had some discussions with the author, and we appreciate the amendment that existing infrastructure couldn't be potentially tolled under a P3, but we still have concerns about potentially using tolling to add capacity to the system. Our members realize that there are demands on highway funding, and we don't have enough to keep up with the project, so we are supporting the traditional investment mechanisms to raise funding in terms of fuel tax increases, registration taxes, and the motor vehicle sales tax, but do have serious concerns about looking at P3s so broadly in terms of potentially having toll bridges in the state of Minnesota. The track record with public-private partnerships hasn't been great. I did notice on one of the handouts that was presented to you reference to the Chicago Skyway and Indiana Toll Road as great examples to look to. Well, after this was published, the company that oversees them had to spin off their investments into sort of a junk bond company because the company was making so little money on this big investment that they were supposed to recoup. So there is a risk there in terms of who picks up that mess. And that's been the experience that we've seen in some other states with some of these public-private partnerships for tolling. One other thing to note is oftentimes that these P3s, as pointed out by the Office of the U.S. Inspector General, don't really create new funds. They just have the upfront private investment and delay when the state actually would pay for them. To quote that report, we found that P3s are not likely to significantly decrease the infrastructure funding gap because private sector investment in transportation through P3s generally does not entail new or incremental funds. Rather, the funds paid up front to the public sector under a P3 are paid in exchange for future revenues, often in the form of tolls. In other words, a P3 primarily changes the timing with which funds become available, not the amount of the funds. A P3 only provides additional funds to the extent that the private sector is willing to pay more for a project, a roadway, for example, than the public sector expects to earn from the project over time. And we do believe, with mention of some of these extremely big projects, such as the St. Croix River crossing or a bridge over the Mississippi near Clearwater, that the only way for these companies to recoup their investments would be for tolling. And yeah,
you know, I just was thinking, you're talking a lot about funding here, and maybe that would be better, we ship this to the finance committee and you can have at it then.
All right. Well, let me just go back to some of the policy comments then.
Okay.
I just want folks on the committee to go into this with eyes wide open, Mr. Chairman. But based on the experiences the Trucking Association has seen and our counterparts around the country with P3s, as I said, they're effectively a loan against future revenue. And to ensure private sector interest, privatized roads require exclusive access and significant traffic volumes. The trucking industry is concerned that an existing bridge would be posted to a lower weight, affecting forcing trucks to use the tolled route to generate revenue. Oftentimes with these arrangements, there's rarely any public input regarding rate setting, and most P3 leases have been negotiated behind closed doors and for very long terms, as in the instance of the Chicago Skyway and Indiana Toll Road of 75 to 99 years. These projects are costly to administer. Public toll facilities eat up 25 to 30% of toll revenue for administration alone, and private toll roads will add a profit margin on top of this, whereas the existing fuel tax has an administrative cost that's rather low of 2 to 3%. And then there's the question about what condition these roads are left in at the end of the lease and what incentive is there to keep up maintenance and potholes when you get to turn it over to the state government when you're done. So just based on those considerations, we'd ask that you further restrict the ability to toll new capacity in this legislation. I think there have been, as others pointed out, some other examples of P3 that have worked, but to just open the door so wide with projects like a St. Croix Bridge or a Clearwater Crossing is of concern to our members. So thank you for your time, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions? For, no questions. Anybody else that would like to testify? I think we should probably get this over to the Transportation Finance Committee, and then if there's some, you can bore down on the funding, which seems to be somewhat of a problem. So I would renew the motion that House File 1204, as amended, be passed and sent to the Transportation Finance Committee. All in favor, please signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed, same sign.
Aye.
The bill is on its is passed and on its way to Transportation Finance. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I'll be charging a toll for that, Mr. Chair.
What?
I'll be charging a toll for this bill, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, I thought you might be. All right. The next one up is House File 1016, Representative Seltzer. And the motion is to... You don't have any amendments for this, I assume?
No, I do not,
okay.
Mr. Chair.
Recommended to pass House File 1016 and sent to the General Register. Please begin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'm proud to carry this bill in the House. This bill is about student safety and about sending a message. This bill would require a party who is chartering a motor carrier or limousine service to have an adult 25 years or older present in the vehicle at all times if alcoholic beverages will be served or transported in the passenger compartments of the vehicle. And if any passenger under 18 years of age, not accompanied by a parent or legal guardian, are in the vehicle. In addition, if the driver or the designated adult observe the possession or consumption of alcohol by a minor during the ride, the trip would be terminated and the passengers returned to the point where the transportation service commenced. So I have with me today Chief Raquet from the Minnetonka Police and Imogene Davis from Tonka Cares to explain why they brought the concept for this legislation forward and why they feel that it is important to pass this bill. So, Mr. Chair, did you want to hear our testifiers, or did you want me to answer questions first?
Well, either way, whatever you'd prefer, we can hear.
Maybe have our testifiers.
Okay.
If that's all right. Thank you very much. Chief McKay.
Good afternoon, Chair and members. My name is Mark Riquet. I'm the Chief of Police for the City of Minnetonka, and I've been a police officer for 28 years. I appreciate the opportunity to talk to you today, and I appreciate the support of Representative Seltzer for supporting this bill. For the past couple of years, our police department, in conjunction with Tonka Cares, who you'll hear from in a minute, have been discussing this topic of party buses, and the activity takes place, and our interest is in trying to identify initiatives to combat these situations. I would also add that recently the Minnesota Chiefs of Police Association supported this in their legislative committee. What was once somewhat limited to weddings and bachelor parties and bachelorette parties has morphed into something of, in our area at least, is almost a status competition, and almost my bus is bigger than your bus. Parents and students rent buses for just about any occasion. They're now renting them for parties on buses or on lakes or boats on Lake Minnetonka. And just recently at a high school dance in our city, just a regular high school dance, seven party buses dropped students off to attend this particular dance. From a parent's perspective, these buses appear to be a safe mode of transportation to school-related functions or other non-related functions, because kids aren't driving, they don't have to worry about that, and there's always safety in numbers in most particular case. But the fact of the matter is, there are things about this mode of transportation that are concerning to law enforcement. For instance, as it stands today, a person 18 years of age can sign a contract without parents knowing about it. And as you know, oftentimes seniors in high school are 18 years old. Parents or other responsible adults aren't frequently on these buses. And the bus drivers have their hands full with driving the bus and can't be responsible for all the activity that's taking place behind them. The bus company is not responsible for ensuring that alcohol and drugs aren't brought on board, even if the passengers are under 21. And more times than not, parents aren't even present when the students board the bus. And if there was a parent there, the likelihood of them wanting to embarrass their child by searching kids before they got on the bus is unlikely to happen. Although that did happen at one particular occasion, the students outsmarted the parent by having the driver bring him to a store to get some pop. And when they stopped, the kids jumped off, went to a car that was strategically parked, retrieved their alcoholic beverages, and off they went. While a majority of companies we believe are reputable, it doesn't take much to buy an old school bus, paint it, outfit it with lights and a sound system, and then advertise it online or in local publication. These entrepreneurs are completely bypassed the licensing and inspection processes in place to protect the motoring public. Anecdotally, there are several instances that I'd like to share with you, just a few instances that happened just this past year. Two in our own community, one in particular, the bus driver smelled marijuana, did the right thing, pulled over, called 911. Believe it or not, by the time we got there, there wasn't a soul left on the bus. They all vanished into thin air. My experience in training tells me something was probably going on there. That same night, we got a call from a parent who was called by her daughter who was on a bus who wanted to be picked up because she didn't like what was going on in the bus. We don't know what happened that night, but we can't imagine it was good. In a suburb just north of Minnetonka, a police department investigated the sexual assault of a juvenile female on a party bus where alcohol was involved. And last August, a student fell out of a window of a party bus while it was moving, and it wasn't until 20 minutes later that they noticed she was gone. When the driver pulled over and called 911, once again there was a mass exodus from the bus, and when law enforcement got there, there were very few people there. And I can tell you, these situations aren't limited to Minnesota. All you have to do is Google party bus fatality, and you'll see several incidences around the country. I want to be clear, this isn't an indictment on the industry. We believe that most operate in a professional manner. We believe that the drivers take their job seriously and take the appropriate action when they observe the behavior. But the fact of the matter is, the buses are loud, there's lights flashing, there's all kinds of stuff going on back there, and they have to concentrate on driving. I will just close with this. I am not one for overregulation, despite my profession in law enforcement. However, in the interest of youth, public health, and public safety, we as police officers feel that party bus regulation is long overdue. While many teenagers can be trusted to make responsible decisions, there is no reason to allow potentially dangerous situations to those who are not yet mature enough to make appropriate decisions for themselves and others. Thank you very much.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and representatives. My name is Imogen Davis, and I'm the project director for the Tonka Cares Coalition. And we've been working to reduce underage substance use in the Minnetonka School District for about 8 years now. The coalition is a partnership between parents, law enforcement, public health agencies, and others, and we implement a variety of strategies to reduce underage alcohol and marijuana use. So I appreciate the opportunity to be here today to talk about party buses. Last April, we hosted a community event where parents had the opportunity to come and talk about underage drinking issues. And this issue was brought forward, beyond any other issues. It was quite prevalent. Similar concerns have been raised and brought to my attention by colleagues in Wayzata, Edina, Minneapolis, among others. Well, parents at those meetings reported serious concerns about the safety of this mode of transportation. So as a result of those concerns being raised, we convened a committee to research the issue and really did a survey of parents in our community, not a big scientific survey, but a survey of peers. So parents on this committee called a number of people that they knew, both those who allowed their children to utilize this option and those who didn't. I talked with several state staff, including staff from MnDOT, from the Minnesota State Patrol, so I could better understand the safety regulations in the contracts, talked to several vendors, and looked around to see what was going on around the country and in other communities. So as Chief Riquet alluded to, we concluded that, you know, for a lot of kids, this can be safe. The current contracting and enforcement situation allows for dangerous behavior aboard these vehicles with little to no accountability, and it's very difficult for parents to monitor. I wanted to give you just a sample of some of the responses we got from parents. So we asked, what are the positives? And this mom said, well, there's a few. Parents save gas getting to and from the dance, and the kids aren't drinking and driving, although when they get off the bus, they can drink and drive. And in fact, in other states, there's been instances where kids have gotten off the bus, intoxicated, driven home. In California, there was a death of a 19-year-old. Negatives, she said, a bus, unchaperoned, dark, with loud music, sex, drinking, drugs, completely skipping the dances because the bus is unchaperoned and more fun than a dance with chaperones. More and more kids bypassing the dances altogether so they can stay on their party bus for the night. She said it created a lot of pressure for us parents when we said no to the bus thing, and so many friends had the opportunity to do so. I mean, if you're the parent of a teen at prom, which I was last year, it's really hard to keep track of who's doing what and who's driving who where. It's a very difficult situation for parents to monitor. Another parent said the same, similar comments, hard to control the alcohol and drugs, need a strong parent in charge and willing to take charge, but that's a big if. Students get put into a high-pressure situation, so even if they're not of the inclination to party, they can end up on these buses and not be able to get off. They're essentially trapped for the night. They don't know what the behavior is going to be. And she asked the same question that we asked, what role does the bus driver take? Is he supposed to regulate underage drinking? Because that's asking a lot. He needs to be safe. So while parental monitoring is a key part of preventing underage substance use, and it's something that we promote, this is a very difficult situation for parents to monitor. These requests are brought forward at the last minute. It's nearly impossible for parents to determine if the situation is safe. So these are situations that are really just a risky party on wheels. And we think this is a particularly risky venue. So with that, thank you. And we're certainly open to questions.
Are there questions or comments from the Representative Mason?
Mr. Chair, and to anyone that would like to answer, I heard the police chief saying that in certain circumstances the police were called and the people were gone. And I've been reading through this, and I'm not seeing that this says that there has to be somebody else besides the driver on the vehicle. So if the driver's, I'm assuming his first priority is driving safely, and even if he does get back to wherever they're going, how do you keep the people on the bus without having more than one person on the bus to be responsible for the riders?
Yeah. Mr. Chair, Representative, there is a language in the bill that talks about if there's somebody under the age of 18 that's going to be on the bus, that there needs to be a adult, responsible adult age 25 or older on the bus with them.
Okay, so that is other than the driver?
Other than the driver, yes, ma'am.
Okay.
Any other questions or comments? Representative Beard.
Mr. Chairman and Chief, is it anticipated this person could be a member of the party renting the bus, or do they have to be an employee of the bus company?
Mr. Chair, Representative, it would not need to be a representative of the bus. It would be somebody other than that a responsible adult, a family member, something like that.
Representative Simonson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is about liability, and I guess my specific question is if the bus company is requiring the chartering party to provide the designee, if you will, is it then the designee that assumes at least a portion of the liability, or is it the bus company that assumes the liability, or neither, or both?
Chief?
Mr. Chair, Representative, it would be if the designee is on board, it would be their responsibility to ensure that there was no illegal or inappropriate behavior on the bus.
I see anybody from the audience would like to testify for or against? Seeing none, I think that we can renew the motion that this be recommended passed as House File 1016 and sent to the General Register. All in favor of that, signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed, same sign. You're on your way. Thanks for the candy there, Representative.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Moline back? Yeah. Representative Moline, House File 1549.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I believe there should be a DE1 amendment as well. Someone could move my bill and my amendment. Okay. I would appreciate that.
We're going to move House File 1549, recommend to pass, and sent to Judiciary. And we have an amendment, which is H1549DE1, which I will also move. Is there any question about that, or we can just put it on the bill? All in favor of adopting the amendment, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. We have your bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, for hearing House File 1549. You should have in your packets a letter from Mr. Mitchell Wakefield and one from David Rapucci, and this is how this bill came about. Originally was to allow the ignition interlock system to be used on an employer-owned vehicle by the employee, so long as the employee has the employer's consent. And so in this particular case, I have a constituent who is on the ignition interlock system and is employed by a construction company and is unable to drive the vehicles at his employer's company due to there being a lack of ignition interlock on the company vehicle. So in this case, the employer is willing to consent to the employee using the vehicle without the ignition interlock system. So we're asking for a statutory change to allow a person to use a company vehicle that doesn't have the ignition interlock system on it. There was also a change, Mr. Chair, in the DE1 amendment that made a change to the interlock system, so that if somebody has the offense of a criminal vehicular offense that is DWI related, they would have the opportunity to opt into the ignition interlock system. From my understanding, it was just basically fell through the cracks in the past, and right now only straight DWI convictions, only those people have opportunity to use ignition interlock. This would allow for people who have a criminal vehicular operation offense that is related to DWI to use the ignition interlock system. And I do have somebody from the Department of Public Safety here to offer comments on the bill as well, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jean Ryan from the Minnesota Office of Traffic Safety in the Department of Public Safety, and I'm really here to just answer questions that you may have on the bill language. If you have any questions about the bill?
Questions or comments? Representative Beard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Lean, this was such a simple little bill, and I looked at 1549, and then this DE amendment came along, which pulls up a whole lot of things that some of us have a lot of have had a lot of discussion about over the years. You should probably let Representative Rukavina buy you a cup of coffee and talk to you about this issue. He and I have had a lot of discussions back and forth. But now that we have Ms. Ryan here, the first question I have is on page 2 of the bill. Do you have the DE amendment in front of you, ma'am? Lines 216 to 219. I'm trying to understand, because I'm not a lawyer, never even played one once in a high school play. What does that mean when we're not pursuing an implied consent revocation?
Mr. Chair, Representative, what this has to do with is currently, if a person is being charged with the criminal vehicular, if a law enforcement officer pulls a person or is in a situation and there's a car crash that occurs and they're going to be charging that person with criminal vehicular operation, mm-hmm. that they are not required to read the implied consent advisory. That is that's their current process, actually. It just puts in statute that they do not read the criminal or the implied consent advisory, that they are eligible at that point just to take blood or urine to test their alcohol concentration level.
Representative Beard?
Mr. Chair, thank you. Ms. Ryan, so what I'm understanding is this is not a pullover because there's a suspicion of impaired driving or driving under the influence. This is if there's already damage or something's happened and they come on the scene of an accident or car in the ditch or something like that. So there's already other cause for things to come to a stop and an officer to be on the scene.
Ms. Ryan?
Mr. Chair, Representative, absolutely. This is only to do with those where the law enforcement officers has probable cause to believe that the person has violated the criminal vehicular operation law so that somebody has been hurt or killed.
Okay. Mr. Chair, thank you. That's quite helpful. The second one has to deal with Section 5 on page 4. And as I'm understanding from reading the overview from nonpartisan staff, apparently what we have, did you find it there in the bill?
No, I'm sorry.
Section 5 starts at line 4.1 on page 4 of the bill.
Sorry. Go ahead.
Got it? Apparently we have rulemaking now. DPS, I think, has rules promulgated. Is that what we're doing? Are these new? Are these existing rules? There's a lot of underlined language here. And I'd like to understand where this came from and what we're being asked to consider here.
Mr. Chair, yes, Representative, ma'am. Some of this was in rule, but in the past, when a person was, when law enforcement came across a CVO situation, they would charge him out with the paperwork for filing a criminal complaint, and the prosecutor would file the criminal complaint. The criminal complaint is what driver and vehicle services would suspend the driving privileges based on. Now, the problem with that, it has been in the past, if you are a DWI offender, I get a notice of revocation at that time. As soon as a law enforcement officer realizes that they have verification, either they refuse the test or they're 0.08 or blood, 0.08 alcohol concentration level or above, they're going to send that in, and driver and vehicle services revokes the driving privileges. In the situation for a criminal vehicular operation in the past, the law enforcement officer would file the paperwork or file the information for the prosecuting attorney to file the criminal complaint, and then finally send it to the driver and vehicle services, and sometimes it was sent and sometimes it was not sent, so the person didn't necessarily lose their driving privileges very swiftly at all. What this is doing, in many times it was months after, especially in the situation of a fatality. So there's been a lot of, if you live in a smaller community and you know this person just killed somebody and they're out driving, continue with their driving privileges, versus a person that got arrested for DWI and did not hurt anybody that loses their driving privileges, it seemed a little inconsistent to the person that's probably lost their loved one. What this does is it changes it, saying that the law enforcement officer can file that probable cause to believe that they violated the criminal vehicular operation law, and driver and vehicle services will suspend based on that that certification that they from the law enforcement officer. So it speeds up and it provides that swiftness and certainty of action, which we know is effective in changing people's driving behavior.
Representative Beard.
I suppose in the long term you could say that it does do that, although immediately they're not driving. But what I'm looking for is this is then, is what I'm understanding you to give testimony to, is that this does not affect existing DWI law. This is only for those places where we actually have criminal vehicular operation where somebody's been hurt or killed, and there's a gap here, and you're saying there's a gap in the process there, and this is what this is attempting to change. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Beard, absolutely. This whole amendment has nothing to do with the other part of the DWI law. It has to do with people that are violating the criminal vehicular operation statute.
Well, Mr. Chair, thank you. Just let me make a concluding comment, and then others have questions, I'm sure. This has been a really tricky thing to deal with because there are a lot of people that are getting caught up in our web of DWI laws, and it's breaking them. And that's why we were happy to try the ignition interlock so that folks can get back to productive lives and keep their job and keep their homes and things like that. So this does not affect that. This is not monkeying with that business at all. That's a whole other fight or a whole other discussion for another day, I guess, is what I'm saying. And any other testifiers that are coming, I would appreciate thoughts or comments on changing it from rulemaking to statute. Is that actually more helpful to be more transparent? And if we as a legislature decide we want to change something, is it better in your opinion to have it in statute or to continue to let the department engage in rulemaking? I don't know the answer. That's an honest question. I'd appreciate anybody's thoughts on that as they come forward to talk about the bill. Mr. Chair, thank you.
Representative Spearsburg.
Thank you, Chairman. And I wanted just also for clarification, it sounded like another part of this this bill is to allow employers to allow people to drive their vehicle without the interlock system. Is that correct?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair and Representative Petersburg, that is correct. The ignition interlock system, I believe, was originally designed so that people were able to continue to work after getting a DWI or commute back and forth to school, to remain productive members of society by being able to continue to use their vehicle. I think we were hearing from too many people that they were losing their jobs because they couldn't get to work because they didn't have a driver's license and some other barriers that people were facing because of DWIs, and I agree with Representative Beard with some of these DWI laws. How many Minnesotans actually have DWI convictions right now, I think, would alarm you. And so the ignition interlock was allowed to them to continue to be productive members of society. What we ran into is there are some people who have to use vehicles at their place of employment. And in this situation, the two letters that you have in your file is an employee from a construction company. And he normally uses the vans and the trucks of the construction company in order to fulfill the duties of his job. He wasn't able to do that under the current statute because those vehicles don't have the ignition interlock on them. So what this is would allow him to use vehicles only at work with the consent of his employer that don't have the ignition interlock on them, and he wouldn't be violating his requirements to abide by the ignition interlock laws.
Mr. Chair, if I could follow up, I guess that's kind of the crux of what I'm thinking is that I think the employer could put the interlock system on his vehicle if he wanted to. But my question to you is are you aware of anybody that's been arrested or charged with driving their vehicle while they're intoxicated? And I think the question is yes. And so the answer then is do we put, just because they say they aren't, doesn't mean that they aren't going to. And the interlock system was a way of guaranteeing that at least they would be sober when they're driving. And wouldn't that be still an important piece of legislation?
Mr. Chair, Representative, currently this statute allows for pilot program participants to get the employment variance. The current law allows for employment variances, but it's only for those that went on ignition interlock as of July 1st of 2011 when you passed that statute that allowed for the expansion of the use of ignition interlock. There was ignition interlock participants that were in the pilot. We had a pilot law for a period of years, and those people were not allowed an employment variance. But the current ignition interlock participants are currently allowed to have this employment variance that is being proposed here. So it's just allowing offenders that were in ignition interlock prior to July 1st of 2011 to get this employment variance in the same process, because the department has created program guidelines and rules around defining who an employment, you know, they work with the employer to make sure that the person is working in within program guidelines and using ignition interlock when appropriate. Thank you.
Any other questions or comments from the committee? Oh, Simonson, Representative Simonson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Refresh my memory. What was the original motion to send to the General Register?
No, it goes to Judiciary.
Okay. Mr. Chair, and maybe to the author, do we have time with this, or are we under a time constraint where we could, if I'm going to ask you if we could get another day to look at this? I mean, I was tagging on Representative Beard's comments. I read this, and this is pretty simple and easy to understand, but this is pretty long, and this is a lot to absorb in a couple of minutes, but I also don't want to cause a problem if it's going to be a problem to hold it over.
Is this a Senate bill?
Mr. Chair.
Okay. Representative Moline.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Simonson. I sit on the Judiciary Committee, so there, you know, we do have plenty of time there. If you wanna discuss this bill with me before then, we can, you know, offer some amendments if that would make you more comfortable. And I'd be happy to sit down with you on the bill too before then.
Mr. Chair, I'd also be, if you'd like me to go through what is in this bill, I can certainly do that as well.
Okay. Anybody else from the audience that needs to testify one way or the other? Aha.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, Pat McCormick, the Director of Driver and Vehicle Services. And
Mr. McCormick, we have some other testifiers and only a few minutes to go, so if you can make it brief, I appreciate that.
The only comment I wanted to make is that we were going to request that the effective date for the first section of the bill, which is listed on 9.2921. Right now it says August 1st, 2013, and we worked on the Senate side to have a July 1st, 2014 effective date, because there are many changes that have to be made in terms of revocation times and the codes that are needed in order to accomplish this. So that would be the only request that we would make, and certainly it can be done in another committee, but I just wanted the committee to know that, because of the fact that our legislation usually comes through this committee.
Representative Boleyn, can you carry that forward to the next committee, suggestion?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I can do that. Thanks.
Thank you. Anybody else that wants? All right. The motion is to recommend to pass 1549 as amended and sent to Judiciary with the good graces of Representative Moline carrying forward the message that you have delivered, and Representative Simonson getting his information after the meeting. How's that sound?
Good. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. We have one more bill. What? Oh, vote. You want to vote on it, too?
I'd appreciate that.
That takes time. I thought we'd run it the next bill. All in favor of that motion, please signal by saying aye.
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 Opposed, same sign. As amended, you're going ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Thank you. Representative Metza, House File 1547.
Don't even start, Mr. Chair.
Well, actually, we usually only allow one ranger a day to speak in this committee. No, go ahead. I will move. This is an informational hearing.
Yeah.
So we're going to pass. So as you get it on the table, I will move House File 1547. Representative Metza, proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Basically, this is a bill discussing how we, or a committee that will be discussing how we do our standards of coatings for painting our bridges in Minnesota. And I'd again like to remind the committee, this is informational only. We basically put this together, the Commissioner of Transportation and MnDOT and myself have been working for a while along with Senator Sieben on the Senate side. And so basically what we're here to do is see if you have any questions about anything in this or about anything about this committee. Otherwise, we are going to be meeting in April, and we would look forward to bringing back what this committee explores and talks about to the committee at that time.
Thank you.
Or I should say after that time, I'm sorry.
Representative Runder.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Realize time is short. I guess very quickly, do we really need a committee, an advisory group to do this? Aren't there standards currently within MnDOT? And what's the problem we're trying to fix?
Mr. Chair, Representative, basically what we're doing, we've been having those discussions, and so originally I had some legislation introduced that would have addressed some of the things that we were looking at in our due diligence and making sure that this works in place with the agencies already in existence, with the Department of Transportation and the Commissioner. We've decided that this would be the next best step to take to have that discussion versus just putting through the actual legislation that we're working on.
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Metza, what are the underlying controversies?
Representative Metza?
Mr. Chair, Representative, basically what we're looking at is, you know, a few different things in the regard to how we do our coding standards and the licensing and procedures that need to be taking place when we have public infrastructure projects that are being worked on. And so this would bring our state to a level standard across all the different people who might have a role in those coding processes, whether it's someone from a MnDOT department who was doing a quick touch-up or whether it was a total repaint on a bridge.
Well, perhaps, Mr. Chair, we can hear from the testifier then, too.
You want to wait? Mr. Larson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Dan Larson with Lockridge Grindle Now, and I'm a contract lobbyist here today on behalf of the Painters and Allied Trades, District Council 82, Painters and Allied Trades Union, representing painters, over 3,000 painters and wall covers, drywall finishers, glazers, glass workers, sign display, screen process, and trade show workers. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. We want to thank Representative Metza for his work as it relates to the issues around training standards for applicators on MnDOT bridges or state and federally funded bridges as it relates to, again, the training and standards of the applicators themselves. We have had an ongoing conversation with folks at MnDOT for going back over a year around some of the ideas that the Painters and Allied Trades folks and their Finishing Trades Institute would like to pursue in terms of elevating certain training standards at MnDOT. We've continued to have those conversations and, in fact, have worked with Representative Metza on proposed legislation. We're very pleased that as a result of those initial conversations with MnDOT, they have agreed to continue to have this conversation in an administrative fashion rather than mandating any study in the legislative process. And so we very much appreciate that with MnDOT, and we look forward to working with MnDOT, with paint contractors, paint manufacturers, et cetera, to have a healthy conversation within the industry regarding what standards should be required on public projects as it relates to coatings, both the application and the removal of coatings on steel structures. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Petersburg.
Thank you. I think that cleared up my question. At first, it sounded kind of like an end run around in which the painters didn't like what the department was saying, and so this is a way of trying to forcing them to do that. But if I understand that you're working together, because the reality is that the Department of Transportation is really our experts, and so we need to have things done their way as well. So thank you for the clarification.
And members, there is a letter in there from the state bridge engineer, Nancy Don Denberger. So that explains that they want to cooperate, and they will meet in April and see what comes of that. Representative Sundin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, to the author and best player there. Thanks for bringing this forward. I've got some experience in this field, and a lot of it actually in the field, but some of it comes from the contractor's perspective. I worked as a consultant with the contractors, and safety is always the biggest issue on a lot of these construction jobs. And north of the Mason-Dixon line, that's State 48 and Hinckley, the last two fatalities in the construction industry were both in the painting industry. One of them on bridge work, one of them on commercial work, and they were from out of state. And I'm just wondering, I think Mr. Larson, you could probably answer this better. When those fatalities occur, injuries occur on those job sites, does that affect the workman's comp rate for the whole industry within the state? I'm just wondering if, you know, if there's better safety standards observed here in Minnesota, and we can kind of foster that with out-of-state contractors as well. Would that help keep our workman's comp rates down for good contractors?
Mr. Larson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Sundin. That would seem a logical outcome, although I hate to speak definitively in an area that I'm not completely expert in, but that's a question that we can get back to you with further information regarding. Certainly the union cares very deeply about the safety of its workers, and that is a component in this discussion as well. But as you can see from the letter that that MnDOT has crafted, these conversations have resulted in an opportunity and over multiple meetings to work together on the issues that remain, safety being one of them. Moving forward, as you know, the state tries to determine what the appropriate standards, training standards, and others related beyond just painting, also as it relates, as you can see, to the issues around disposal of paints and chemicals on the projects. All those things that having a healthy conversation within the industry is really to the benefit of all involved, and I think ultimately the state and state taxpayers.
Any other questions? Comments? Representative Beard?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I'm just noticing here, Mr. Larson, the author, just this seems to be driven by the Painters Union, And I want to be just on the record here as asking you whether the intention is that it shuts out all the merit shops. That is this going to be skewed so that only if you're a union painter or a union contractor that you're going to be attending this, having this discussion, and you'll be the only ones able to work on the contracts in the future the way the thing is jiggered? Or are these cookies already baking, or is this actually going to be an open process?
Representative Mesa?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Beard, we are being inclusive of everyone who wants a say in this, and it's why it got to this point, actually, was to continue the conversation, both with those concerned parties, myself, and the people would be enforcing what ultimately we were coming up with, which is Department of Transportation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
The one thing I'd add, Mr. Chair, is and Representative Beard, is if you go back several steps in this process, one of the things that the Painters Union had been advocating for was a national certification program that we visited with MnDOT about that's called the SSPC Systems for Protective Coatings has a certification program. And in fact, in their certification program, there are more non-union contractors in the paint contracting area than there are union contractors, as we understand it. So, in fact, very much it's I understand the issue that you ask and why you'd ask it, given the fact that we're advocating for it. But in fact, there are more non-union contractors with that certification than there are union contractors countrywide. So. But appreciate the question, and we certainly are not trying to use this as a method for that. It's more for purposes of as experts in this craft, as applicators, trying to create the highest standards, both within the industry and for the workers, but also for the state. Thank you.
Thank you for coming in and for the informational hearing that we've had, and so we're going to adjourn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
He said he appreciated the question.
Civil law.
Thank you. Yeah, 400 north. Come and go if you please. We've got to caucus the omnibus policy bill and then start talking about the finance bill. So. And I'm going to try to work out an agreement between the UTU and then I'm working on that. So I'll let you know how that goes. Oh, you're going to meet with them? Oh, okay. I have that on mine, too.
I'll be up there in a few minutes.
My office? Okay. Okay, can you come?
Yep.
Okay.
Are you kidding?
Yeah.
So, is it? Yeah.